When the topic of parking is discussed in a planning context, the reaction most people have is that there isn't enough of it. People want convenient parking located as close to the front door as possible, and when this isn't the case, think that there's a real problem. And the truth is, they're right. Your city does have a parking problem. But the real parking problem your city has is that there is a massive oversupply of parking, and your city policies actually require too much of it, which has the effect of encouraging more people to drive. In today's episode, we will come to terms with your city's real parking problem and what you can do to help shape the policy conversation in a data-driven way. I'm Alex Huffman, and this is City Planning Matters. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of City Planning Matters. Again, I'm your host, Alex Huffman. As I mentioned in the top of the episode, today we were going to be discussing parking. And I know for some of you, you may think, well, parking is not going to be that interesting of a topic. It's not very sexy. It doesn't make headlines. But the truth of the matter is that if you care about issues like design or urban design, transportation, or just your city's economic well-being, then you really need to care about parking. And, you know, as is the issue with all these things that we discuss here, I am by no means the subject matter expert. I just, you know, really try to pay attention to what other cities are doing, read, you know, what the experts are saying about parking. And along those same lines, you know, if anything you want to learn more about today, you really should seek out, you know, the parking god, if you will, within the field of planning, who is Donald Shoup. For those of you who don't know, Donald Shoup was a professor at UCLA. He's now retired, but still does quite a bit of advocacy work as it relates to parking and parking reform. And so he actually has two books out. One is called The High Cost of Free Parking, and I'm blanking on what the second one is. But really just go and seek out his resources. He does a lot of different papers that are short. For people who don't think there is a lot to talk about with parking, both of his books are like several hundred pages, like 400, and the other one's like 600 pages, something crazy. So there's a lot of stuff that as it relates to parking and why parking is important. But really what I want to discuss today is, you know, how parking affects these three major issues from my perspective, and then how you can visualize the impact that it's having on these three issues to help you articulate how these particular things are problematic for a city and why maybe your city should look at doing parking reform. And so, as I mentioned, there's these three things that I think are really influenced by parking. The first one is going to be design. And so when we talk about design, I think the best way to maybe help frame this topic or this issue in your mind is to visualize or find a photo of your city, say, from before the 1950s, and then look at the same picture today. And I think that the most dramatic change that you will see probably is going to be in either your downtown proper or the areas that directly surround your downtown, where you'll see this dramatic change in the city landscape. And really the reason for that is just because that really marked the era or the time where, as a country in the US, we shifted from being a country that relied more on mass transportation or walking to one that was dominated by vehicles. And so a lot of the attention, and rightfully so, gets placed on the highway system, but also recognizing that the highways connected different destinations across the country from city to city, but then will also, you know, intra-transit, right? So it started connecting other major routes within your city to one another. And that's really where we see the beginning of, you know, the strip commercial development pattern, just to give you an idea. That's where we started seeing the strip malls. That's where we started to see, you know, the design where no longer are the buildings all the way up to the front of the street, but now they have a large surface lot in the front because they were trying to be attractive to people who owned automobiles. And that's around the same time where, because of the strip commercial development pattern, also people leaving cities in mass exodus to the suburbs, that cities that were like, you know, large urban areas struggled with how do we compete with these suburban areas. So as a result, they started tearing down buildings to provide more parking because they thought, well, if we provide more parking, we can compete with suburbs. And of course, we know today how that turned out. And so really, the key takeaway of that visualization or that picture in your mind is that in reality, we designed our cities starting at that point for cars. And so I would say that, you know, unless your city has undertaken significant parking reform and, you know, do some of the things I'm going to discuss later in this episode, that chances are that more than likely your city is continuing to design for cars. And so what does that mean when we design for cars? So typically, and I'm going to use this as a very broad example, there are always exceptions to these things, but just I can tell you from my experience, what I see is that when we design for cars and when we're designing in a auto dominant type of development pattern, typically engineers and architects, when they're designing a site, so let's imagine there's a particular parcel of land that's vacant, you're getting a development proposal, you're looking at it. The major deciding factor in like what the building ultimately looks like, how large the building is, where the building sits on the property is completely dependent on parking, right? Because the number of parking spaces that are required is determined on the square footage of the building. And so if you want to, you know, build a 10,000 square foot building, but you know, you only have enough parking for an 8,000 square foot building, well, guess what you build? An 8,000 square foot building. And so really you have to start first with the design of the parking, because the design of the parking and the number of parking spaces you actually can put on your property is going to determine how large of a building you get. And so when we design for cars instead of people, the actual building is secondary, which is wild when you think about it. You know, the building should be the primary thing, how it interacts with the street, whether or not it's attractive as a destination. But what we know all too often to be the case is that it's secondary because you have to meet these parking requirements first. And so, you know, if you don't believe, you know, what I'm saying, look at the land area of parking, you know, that's consumed in square footage versus the building. Buildings that are located on the fringes of downtown, or, you know, or, you know, in the fringes of your city or in suburban environments, they're very infrequently are more than 50% of the lot, typically because parking won't allow for it. A real specific example is thinking about housing, right? So we talked in another episode about missing middle housing and how parking was a really important consideration in that, because as an example, your city may allow for, say, you know, 50 units per acre. But if you still require two parking spaces for every single one of those units, it really doesn't matter what the density calculation is, because the only way that you're going to be able to put that many units on that property is A, if it's large enough to accommodate all that parking, or if you do, you know, structured parking, which can be really cost prohibitive, especially if you're trying to make it affordable. And so, you know, that really begs the question, right? Is that if we're designing for cars instead of people, like what matters more? Like, shouldn't people matter more? You know, or what is more important, to provide more parking or more housing? And it seems that the way that our codes are set up is that parking is more important than housing, which again, sounds crazy to say out loud, but when we look at our priorities and our outcomes, they sometimes don't match. They're saying one thing, but doing the other. The next thing that I think parking really affects is transit. And so when you provide for more parking, more surface parking, it ensures that people will drive. So again, you know, this isn't just my opinion. This is based on what the data shows, that if you look, for example, at the census and look at the trip mode of, like, you know, how people commute to work, right? So, like, do they go by car? Do they go by mass transit? And you're looking at the locations in which they work, and you can get that information from the census. They have a resource that's called On the Map, and you can actually look at, like, origin destination type of data as it relates to workers. And you can see that the areas of the city that have more parking have more people commuting by automobile. And it's just a fact. And a good way to think about that is that, you know, if you have the choice between driving in a car or taking a bus, and it's more convenient, or it's just as convenient to, you know, drive there, right? Because you know that you're going to find a parking space. Under what circumstances will you ever take the bus? Because the bus is going to be slower. The bus is going to maybe not take you exactly to your destination. So it's going to make your trip longer. And so the only people who are going to be using transit or using a bike or walking to their destination are people that absolutely have to, if you provide too much parking, because you're incentivizing and making it too easy for people to arrive to their destination by car. And so a way that you could actually test this out is that if your city collects transit data, you can see where people are getting on and off by stop. You can look and see, like, are we having higher rates of transit ridership in locations where we have a lot of surface parking, or are they going to places in the city where we maybe don't have as much parking and people are using it because it's a very realistic and viable alternative? I can speak in my city that where we're seeing our highest transit ridership rates are in areas of our city where parking isn't as available. And these areas where maybe are these highly trafficked corridors, you know, they also have a lot of parking, so people aren't using transit. And so I think a really helpful exercise to do to see, you know, do an audit, if you will, to figure out, like, does my city say one thing, you know, going back to this issue of having transit supportive type of policies, is my city saying that we want to be transit supportive, but on the other hand, we're making different policy decisions? A good way to look at that is if you're able to visualize, which I'll get into later, the locations of parking, and then also look at where your bus routes are offered. Are they in the same spots? Because if they're in the same areas of the city, so, like, we have rapid transit in our city, and in the same locations where we have rapid transit, we also have a lot of parking. And so from a policy decision, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, right, that we're saying, like, hey, we want people to ride the bus, we're going to offer a rapid transit service, but at the same time, we're going to offer a ton of parking. The two are at odds with the other, you know, with one with the other. And so to do one well, to have good transit, means that you really should not be providing its true competitor, which is surface parking. And so just as an exercise to go through before you even begin the analysis would be, like, really helpful to see, like, okay, look at where transit is offered in my city, and can I visually see that there's a lot of surface parking? It'll give you a good idea of, you know, what type of work you have cut out for you. And then the last point that I think is really important before we get into this question of, like, how do we show this information, is financial health. And it's something that, you know, I talk about from time to time. There are podcasts out there that exist that talks just about financial health of cities and making good decisions as it relates to development and policy for financial purposes. But I do want to reinforce it again here, is that when we think about surface parking is essentially worthless as an improvement. And so typically cities are taxing, you know, land value and improvement value is exactly the same. And if you have the choice of taxing improvement versus taxing land, and, you know, I'm saying land as one and the same as parking, because the, you know, asphalt is not very valuable, and so it's pretty much unimproved land, that the money that you receive, or that the city receives through taxing parking, surface parking, is minuscule compared to the value that is generated from a building. And so I think I looked at this and I'm trying to think of like what the exact number was, but I want to say that the value difference between the improvement value citywide versus land value with just parking, asphalt parking on it, the difference in value was like a multiple of, I want to say somewhere between 30 and 40. So a property that has a building on it, it's 100% built out as a building, is going to produce 40 times, 30 times the revenue that a building with parking will when you look at just the parking area. And so it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense from a financial perspective to be requiring parking, because essentially you're saying, like, as a city, hey, we want to get very little tax value out of this portion of your land. And again, going back to the fact that like a lot of this suburban style development, 50% of the land is occupied by this worthless improvement, you're really setting yourself up for failure. And it's failure because the reality of the situation is that even if it's just surface parking, you're still providing services to that land. And so as an example, you know, you still have to extend water and sewer to that property, and it just gives it further distance that that pipe needs to travel in order to actually reach its destination, which is the building, from the street. You're still providing police and fire protection. And again, you know, it's, you know, to this building, it's to the surface lot. And all you're doing is you're spreading things out even more because you're dedicating more land area to parking, spreading everything out. And now the distance that your emergency services have to travel to provide that service increases. At the same time, you're not producing the same amount of taxable value that you could if you required less parking. And so just from a financial standpoint, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for cities to be requiring the parking, because like I said, it results in like really bad environment for design. It really creates challenges as it relates to transportation. And then last, you know, all these things, you put them together, that they just don't make sense financially for cities to be requiring the parking. And so that gives us a good basis for, you know, your city's parking problem, right? These are the issues that can arise when you require too much parking. And so after the break, what I want to talk about is what are some different ways that we can visualize, you know, the amount of parking that you have or some of these issues so that you can determine the magnitude of your city's parking problem and then help use that information to help articulate why your city should probably make some different policy decisions. Okay, so before the break, we talked a little bit about what were some of the issues that can arise from having too much parking, which is really your city's parking problem. It's not having too little, which I know that that's sometimes people's perceptions. And what we discussed were three high-level topics. We looked at physical design, and then we looked at transit and transportation, and then finally we looked at financial health. And really what we were trying to just demonstrate there was that when we design for cars and not for people, that all three of these things suffer, right? We get really poor design, we get really poor outcomes as it relates to supporting mass transit, and then financially our cities really suffer. And so these are really important issues in planning. And as is the discussion with a lot of our different episodes here, that where we're at right now as a profession, as a field, is that we have the opportunity to better articulate our positions and support our positions with data and information, because we didn't have the tools available to us to do that, right? We always knew probably that parking was a problem, but we were never really able to visually show and demonstrate the magnitude of the problem that it creates for our cities. And so what I want to do now is talk about what are some different ways and tools that you can use to help articulate and demonstrate the challenges that are created by having too much parking in your city. And the way that I've organized these things in my mind is from ease of execution and then also how easily accessible the information is. And, you know, from probably like a beginner type of thing, which shouldn't really take too much effort, to more of a, I don't want to say like an expert, but it's certainly more advanced and takes a little bit more analyzing data and really having more resources available in order to execute it. And so the first way that I found success when I was trying to figure out like, how do I show my city's parking problem is to start with your central appraisal district website. And so if your appraiser has an online system, what they should have is that they should make available data either complete for download, or if you want to look at specific parcels. And I would always recommend that you start with like a small sample size to test out the way that you're doing a methodology before you invest a lot of time into a methodology and find out that the result or the way that you've analyzed the data is not correct. So like always start with small areas. So I would suggest, you know, you start out with maybe a couple of blocks where you know that, you know, there is this perceived parking problem, and you can really focus on those parcels first and gather the information and then test out your hypothesis there. And so go to your central appraisal district, see if they have like the mass file available for download. And the way that our appraisal district has their data set up is that they break the data up into like different files. And so they'll have files for like related all about values, and they'll have another one just about property ownership. But then they do have files then specifically as it relates to land and then also for improvements. And so I think the one that's most valuable for this discussion is to look at a combination of land and improvements. We want to know land information because we need to know like how large the parcel is, what is the value attached to like land values, because that's really important in this discussion when we think about like what the multiplier effect is on having building versus just vacant land. And then improvements is like very, very necessary, which, you know, I would say if you want to start somewhere, start with improvements, because improvements is going to tell you how much of a particular property is used for some type of improvement. And like I mentioned, even though it's not valuable, asphalt parking is still an improvement. And so they should be able to identify on your central appraisal district information how much of the land is dedicated towards asphalt. So let's say that you do that. You've pulled your assessor data information. Hopefully it's not too large of a database. If it is, pull it in through Access, Microsoft Access rather than Excel, because Excel is limited in terms of the number of cells and it will crash your computer, I guarantee it. So, you know, start, you know, figure out the right way to get your information in your computer. You've done that. Now you've narrowed down all of your records just to asphalt parking or concrete paving. You know, you'd look and see, you know, what is the value or what is the descriptor of the improvement that describes parking. So for me, it was asphalt paving, it was concrete paving. That's what I was interested in, because you could have parking lots made of concrete or you could have parking lots made of asphalt. So you do that. Now you have all the square footages, you have the locations of where all that asphalt and that concrete paving are. Now you have to figure out, okay, how much square footage corresponds to a parking space. So a good rule of thumb, if you're going to be using it, is about 330 square feet per parking space. Donald Shoup in his book, I believe, uses 400 square feet. But the way you think about it is that if a parking stall is 9 by 18, I think that's 172 square feet. You need to also identify some additional land for the travel lane and the driveway. And then also if your city has like a landscape requirement, you have to incorporate that to figure out like, okay, when we're talking about asphalt, like how much is actually dedicated for each parking space. So I would say you take that square footage that's dedicated towards asphalt or concrete paving, and you divide it by either 330 or 400. It's going to give you the same general numbers, unless it's like a really large area, in which case there would be some differentiation in values. So that number is going to give you an estimated number of parking spaces that exist per property. And so what you can do with this information is, now that you have an estimated number of parking spaces, you can visualize on a map the locations of these parcels, and you can start to see like, dang, where do we have so much parking? And more than likely, it's going to be, you know, you're going to see large amounts of parking along your highways, along like your state roadways or your major arterials. That's a really good way for you to see whether or not, you know, you're headed in the right direction in terms of methodology. is if we're seeing high numbers of parking, estimated number of parking spaces along areas where we would expect to see them. If not, you probably did something wrong. So that's like the first methodology. I would try that out, see if your assessor has that information. If you're saying to yourself like, well, my assessor doesn't have that information available publicly, you can always get that information through Freedom of Information Act. But if you don't want to go that route, I have a website for you that I would highly recommend that you can also get this data from. So there's a website that's called LandGrid. LandGrid, their whole purpose is to provide parcel information for all the land throughout the US. And they achieve that, I think they're at like a 97% of coverage that they have, that they're able to, you know, give you parcel information, all the information that the assessor collects, they have it on their database. And so I think they allow for, I want to say 50,000 records of download available per month. So if you have a large area that you're looking at, you would have to take a little bit of time to download all the information. But once you have it, you'll be able to do that analysis. Okay, so like that was probably the easiest way. It's not exact because we're doing estimation because, you know, obviously the assessor probably doesn't have information on number of parking spaces. So let's say you want to get a little bit more exact. How could you do that? Well, the way that I would do it and the way I've done it, I've tried it, is to use Google Earth. And so Google Earth, as you know, allows you to look at aerial photography. But one of the things that's really cool about it is that you can also go back in time. And so what you could do is you could select different dates and times in the past to get a good sample size. You could, you know, select, you know, weekdays, weekends, you know, maybe a particular day where you get a lot of traffic and, you know, another day where you're not getting a lot of traffic, and see how it influences the number of parking spaces available. But the idea is that you would have, you know, an aerial photograph that you're working off of. You would draw polygons around all your surface lots that you're interested in analyzing, and then use your time back machine with the slider, the date slider on Google Earth, to see what is the parking utilization by polygon. So one of the great things about using the historical data is that they actually give you the date of when the aerial photograph was taken. So you can know for a fact, is this a weekday? Is this a weekend? What day of the week is it? Now, the one challenge with Google Earth is that they do not timestamp their images. So there is a way that you can do that. And what I would recommend is that there's some websites that are out there, not one in particular, but if you look for, you know, a way that you can do, use a sundial for trying to figure out, like, based on the shadows that are on the ground in the Google Earth image, you can more or less approximate the time of day that the photograph was taken. And so the way these websites work is essentially you use like almost like a compass type of thing to figure out, okay, the shadows appear to be directly north-south. Based on that, based on the date that the photograph was taken, this is more or less the time that this photograph was taken. It's a really great way. I've tested it, it works, it's true. And so I would really recommend that. The benefit is that, again, if you're trying to have this conversation, people will always try to poke holes in your methodology. And so like the parking estimation is a good place to start. I wouldn't recommend using it to make informed policy decisions because it's not exact enough. Going the Google Earth route is really good because you're gonna have actual numbers. People are gonna try and poke holes and say, well, you don't know when the photograph was taken, so it may have been off peak time. You have the ability to use this particular tool to say, well, no, actually that's not true. I can estimate the time and this is the way I can do it. It's hard to refute it, science, it's fact, you know. So I would just really try to stress that to say that this is probably a better methodology to use if you're interested in trying to figure out, you know, the exact number of parking spaces, because you'll be counting the exact number of parking spaces, you'll see the exact utilization rate. And then you'll also be able to say date and time, this is when this was taken. And then you can really compare across the timeline and say like, hey, the average utilization in this particular area of our city is 62%. And as a result, we should look to reduce parking by at least, you know, 38%. And you have those facts and you have that information. A really great resource and tool to think about how maybe you want to structure a study like this would be, I would recommend taking a look at a website. It was called Perfect Fit Parking. And it was done by this organization called MAPSE. And MAPSE is based out of, I think, the Boston metro area. And they did this type of study where they actually went and physically counted parking in residential, like multifamily apartments, because they were trying to build the case for getting rid of minimum parking requirements for multifamily. And so they went and they actually said, like, what is the utilization rate of these, of the parking facilities associated with multifamily projects? And based on their findings, you know, they were making these recommendations of ways to change policy. And so, like, let's say, okay, this is a really cool thing. You know, we've tried, we started the conversation using the assessor data. We've now moved to Google Earth to get more specific information. We, you know, we can see these different snapshots in time, but maybe, you know, your council or people are still saying, well, you know, you only picked 5 dates and it is not representative of truly what's the case. What information could you use to help, I think, maybe refute their perspective, but then also to reinforce what you're trying to achieve, which is to say that, like, your city has too much parking. Well, the way that I've tried to articulate that and structure that conversation is really about using origin destination data. And so if you have access to it, and I know that some of you may not, so this is not doable, but this is, like, really that advanced, because it takes a lot of finessing the data and making sure that, you know, you're representing things correctly. But what you can do is you can use origin destination data to then show by day, by hour of day, over a period of time, utilization rates. And so the way that you can do that is if, for example, based on your Google Earth analysis that you knew, and I'm just using the example that I use it for, that an aerial photograph was taken at 2:20 on February 27th, 2020, so before the pandemic, at around 1:30. I can look at origin destination data and say, okay, based on this business location, we know that for sure in Google Earth that there were, I don't know, 8 parking spaces. I use the origin destination data. The origin destination data is saying that, you know, there are 4 visitors to that. We know that when we're seeing the number 4 for that hour number 1, really what that represents is actually 8 parking spaces. And I wouldn't recommend doing it just for, like, a couple of dates, because you really need to do this multiple times in order for the sample size to be large enough to, like, make these assumptions. But I guess my point is that what you're able to do is, if you did the analysis using Google Earth a number of times, you have origin destination data that you can match up those very specific data points with the origin destination data to your, what you have is ground truth data, which is your Google Earth image. What you can start to do is start to use that information to say that this is, you know, a representative sample size of, say, 10% of true trips. And as a result, I can look at parking utilization by hour across a spectrum of time. And I have the ground truth data through Google Earth to, you know, support what I'm saying. And so one of the really cool things is that then you can show, like, parking utilization rates, not only in a snapshot in time, but then you can also use it, like, over a period of time, because you're using the origin destination data to help, you know, extend out the analysis over a longer period of time. And so let's say you've done all these things. You now have a lot of data points. You've used these different analyses. You've visualized them in these different ways. You know, you can show where there's high rates of parking spaces. You can show that where there's high rates of parking spaces, there's low utilization rates. What types of things do you need to be looking at? Well, you know, I think that the first thing, and this is something obviously that, you know, if you do read Donald Shoup's work that he always talks about, is that you need to get rid of parking minimums. That is absolutely the thing that you need to do. You know, you really should, as a matter of just best practice, you really should be looking at the market determining what the best number of parking spaces are. So, you know, as an example, going back to housing, you know, if people don't want to live in an apartment building that doesn't have parking, then, like, that's their choice. They don't want to live there, they don't live there, right? But somebody who doesn't have a car, and it doesn't matter to them whether or not they have a dedicated parking space, like, that should be fine too. And I think that just as a best practice, parking is something that's best decided by the market, and really the city should butt out of it, to be completely honest. The one caveat to that, and I would say this is really what the second thing that's really important about the parking discussion, is that also making sure that there are tools in place that actively discourage people from providing too much parking. So that was, like, one of the really interesting things. There was actually a study that was put out recently by the Journal of American Planning Association, JAPA, I think maybe 2 months ago, that looked at the effects of getting rid of parking minimums. And so what the study found was that people actually were providing less parking, but there were still some, I don't want to call them like bad actors, but people who were still providing more parking than the city allowed or wanted to see, which was, you know, like none, right? We don't want to see continue adding to the parking inventory. And so one of the things that I think is really important is that if you, for example, go through the process of doing this analysis, you are successful in getting rid of parking minimums in your city. One of the things that I think should really be considered is putting in place hard parking maximums. Just because going back to the discussion that we had at the top of the episode is that there are still very serious implications that, you know, if the market doesn't respond to the change in policy, they don't respond to having no parking minimum, so they provide less parking. You want to have a tool that is in your, you know, your toolkit that says that, like, okay, if you're going to provide parking, you can't provide more than this, and there's no way out of it. You can also use fees. So fees for providing, you know, structured parking or for providing better transit system as a really good tool to really use that as like a stick to get people to provide less parking, because really the implications of providing too much parking are tremendous. We laid them out at the top of the episode, and it's really important that not only do you, you know, set the floor at zero, but it's also really important that as a policymaker, as a decision maker in your city, that you really start to push the envelope to getting people to provide less parking. And if they're not responding, you need to have adequate tools in your tool belt to really start pushing people that direction. And so I would say that the second part to that then is, for sure, you know, if people aren't responding, providing less parking, put in place parking maximums. A good place to put, you know, your parking maximums at is usually what your old parking minimums used to be. For those of you who don't know, the way that parking minimums generally are created is that there's an ITE manual, engineers put it out, where basically they went to like different locations around the country and they counted how many people were utilizing parking at the peak. And so the parking minimums a lot of time are based on the peak usage, which is why our utilization rates are typically so low. So as a general rule of thumb, you know, your parking maximum probably at the very least should be your current existing parking minimum, which is based on maximums of the ITE manual. I know that does not make any sense, but I promise you it's true. Go look at it. If you ever want to, you know, have trouble falling asleep, go look at the ITE manual for parking. You'll see that their sample sizes are teeny tiny. Like they only use like two or three businesses to make the parking generation. And so it's not really a good guide, but like for whatever reason, the planning profession historically has relied on it. And so I think that doing these different visualizations will help further that conversation. I think that it will show that your city does have a parking problem, that it has too much parking, that a lot of times it has the effect of destroying, you know, the quality design of the city that the city is probably looking to achieve. It works against your transit systems, because when you provide too much parking in areas of where you're trying to put transportation infrastructure in place, it just encourages more people to drive. And then third, and probably most important for, you know, broader applications, that it really hurts your city financially, just because taxable value is not there for surface parking. And so I think that that sums up this conversation. I hope that you found it interesting. If you have any questions about methodology, always feel free to reach out to me. You know, there's a link in my page to leave a message. You can also look me up on LinkedIn. I'm always there to help, you know, discuss these types of issues, because they are really important. And, you know, I deal a lot in this space. And so I'm always looking for different ways to represent this information. So I hope you enjoy today's episode, and look forward to speaking with you next week. Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you're enjoying the content, don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen and rate the podcast so we can continue to improve the content of each episode for our listeners. I'm Alex Huffman, and this is Planning Matters.